We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In most countries around the world, well-being is measured almost exclusively in economic terms. However, it's not the only way to think about well-being. And in fact, if you live in a country with a growing economy, that does not necessarily mean that all people will be provided with the means to flourish. Just what are the connections between economic growth and quality of life in a country? This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Sabina Alkire. She is director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative at University of Oxford, where they do research on poverty and poverty amelioration. She is here on the campus of the University of Illinois to give the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. The lecture is free and open to the public. The title, How an Adequate Notion of Human Flourishing Challenges Economics. And she'll be speaking at 8 o'clock this evening in the tomorrow night in the night auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. That's on South Gregory in Urbana. And as I said, it's free, open to the public. Anybody who was interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Sabina Alkire. She grew up in Champaign, attended the University of Illinois and also Magdalen College at University of Oxford, where she was a Rhodes Scholar. She is economist and an Anglican priest. She completed her master's degrees in theology and also in economics at Oxford, and as I said, now directs the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative. That's a research center within the university that was launched in 2007. And we're very pleased to have her here in the studio with us. And as we talk, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I think that this raises a number of really interesting questions about this basic question of when you're assessing a society and how it's doing and how people are doing, how do you do that? And certainly there are many ways to do that. The most conventional ways probably being things that do have to do with money, gross domestic product, and individuals' incomes and so forth. What are some of the shortcomings of approaching it that way?
There's a very interesting poem about women protesters in 19th century. And the poem ends by the women saying, "Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses." And I think one of the shortcomings of GDP is just the many aspects of human flourishing that it leaves out. This was very well put already in the 60s by Kennedy and has been recognized in many different ways. The GDP excludes pollution, it excludes security considerations, it excludes emotional well-being, loneliness, mental illness. And it's not as highly correlated as many people think with the things that they value in life. This isn't to say that income isn't tremendously important, because it very much is. But measuring income or GDP alone is not going to direct the investments a country can make at the well-being of its citizens. The Sarkozy Commission, which was chaired by Stiglitz and Amartya Sen, Joe Stiglitz, Amartya Sen, and Fitoussi, released a report on the adequacy of GDP and argued that it was a very good measure of many things, but it was not the right measure to take as the single objective for the economy of a society because it gave misleading signals. And so they did recommend it be adjusted for environmental considerations. It be adjusted basically also to reflect better the economic situation itself and quality of life. And Joe Stiglitz, in his op-ed about that commission in the Wall Street Journal, said, you know, we do need a metric of well-being that we can use to direct our investments, because if we're aiming at the right target, we have a better chance of meeting it. Hmm. So I think thinking about measurement issues is only the start of a conversation, but it's an important start because at the present, the measures that we have are woefully inadequate.
Well, I'm sure that some people would say that even if inadequate, things like GDP and individuals' incomes and household incomes are something that are – these are easily quantifiable because they're all about numbers.
Mm.
That the other sorts of things that you're talking about, other aspects that contribute to people's quality of life, maybe it's more difficult to quantify this in a way that governments and large bureaucracies like to do, because mm-hmm. the other things fit neatly into number form and you can put them in tables and you can put them in reports. Is it possible to do that with these other indicators of quality of life, actually to assign values to them in a way that you can do that and then come up with a picture of a country that you can that's then comparable? So then you can compare one country to another and say some larger things about how a region is doing or how the world is doing.
Absolutely. In fact, in some cases, it can be easier and more accurate to do. Income is measured and reported partly by convention that we have learned to do it and we have set up systems of doing that on a regular basis. However, income and consumption data are also poor in some cases that people will perhaps lie about their income, or they may not know if they're not on a salary exactly how much they earn. Or they may not be able to attribute prices if they grow some of their own food. And so particularly in developing countries, income data are of variable quality depending on how exactly the survey that gained those data was administered. So income itself is not unproblematic. And at the same time, measuring whether or not a household has electricity, whether its flooring is of dirt or concrete, these are quite tangible and very easy to do and very quick to do. So it doesn't take a lot of time on a questionnaire, and hence it is not expensive information to collect. So there are a number of indicators which are, in a sense, low-hanging fruit, that the questions are well known, can be easily fielded and easily analyzed. Then there are other aspects of well-being, such as empowerment, safety from violence, a feeling of dignity, or a lack of humiliation. And these are not as well known. Their economists are not as comfortable with them. And some of them rely on subjective data, which require more care in interpretation. And so these are, in a sense, a second level of indicators that are key to well-being, and in which there are many more quantitative techniques now and survey questions now for internationally comparable data than there have been in the past. Mm-hmm. So when the GDP system was set up, these kinds of quantitative opportunities were not open to those economists. Yeah.
And this is, you've been actually working on something that would do this?
Yes, we work very much on different measures. In well-being, we have only worked with the country of Bhutan, where we implemented the Gross National Happiness Index, which that country uses. But we work much more on poverty measurement. At the national level, the government of Mexico has adopted an official multidimensional poverty line, which we had the privilege of working with them on, which has replaced their income poverty measures. And now for the United Nations Development Program, we are constructing a new multidimensional poverty index of very acute poverty in over 100 developing countries, comparing them on the basis of malnutrition, child mortality, lack of even 5 years of schooling, children who are out of school, lack of electricity, dirty cooking fuel, no clean water, very, very basic assets. And we can do comparisons that are relatively robust for, as I said, over 100 countries. It's very different information than income, and our results are very interestingly different from income poverty. But I think they complement and they bring to life a part of the story which has been left in darkness.
Hmm. Well, I think this would invite the question, if you had such a system in place, say what they're already doing in Mexico and what may be done other places, what will that tell you that you didn't know before?
One thing is just very evident. We want to reduce poverty. But if we have data on income, and yet we know that to increase income, we need to invest in education so that the people can work and have more productive working lives. We need to invest in health so they're not absent from their jobs so much. So there are multiple investments we have to make to increase income. If we measure these things directly, we can see in the very short term who does and does not have these inputs. And it helps us to target poverty reduction activities, mm-hmm. because, I work much more on poverty than on well-being, more actively. For example, two states in India, Bihar and West Bengal, had nearly the same multidimensional poverty. But in Bihar, poverty was much more driven by a lack of assets, you know, no radio, no television, water. And in Bihar, in West Bengal, it was much more a lack of education and of nutrition. And so if a policymaker knows that, then they are able to make a very effective use of limited public resources. And similarly, if private sector or charities wish to engage, they know exactly where their inputs will have the highest impact. And in a time of fiscal tightening, I think that kind of information is very needed.
So that it would help you in terms of tailor your development strategies in a way so that you'd put your resources in the place where it most mattered. And you would maybe have some data to go on rather than guessing or just saying, well, this is what we're used to doing, so we'll do that. That what it actually does is it gives you something more concrete as a way of deciding how it is you're going to direct your resources.
Yes, it's very concrete. And it's concrete both in terms of the aspects of poverty and the groups. So, for example, we looked at poverty among different ethnic groups or different castes or different states in countries. And you can see differences that are stark among the, using India again, among the states in India, poverty ranges from 15%, according to our measure, to 83% across different states. In Mexico, in their multidimensional poverty measure, they highlighted the difficulties of indigenous people, whose poverty is much more deep and broad, pervasive than that among non-indigenous populations. So again, it helps them to target the groups that they can most effectively address the poverty of.
Having, if you're using this more multidimensional approach in assessing poverty, and then that's something that you can use as a tool to thinking about how you do your development. Just taking a step back, though, with that approach, does that say that actually poverty is more widespread than we thought, that it touches more people, that it's more serious, or is that really not the point, but that it's getting a more detailed understanding of people's lives and what they need?
It's a very good question. Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate in economics, who's an advisor to our research center and whose work we build on a great deal, argues, I think rightly, that poverty is a value judgment. You know, who you and I would consider poor might differ from whether that person would consider themselves poor or other people would. And so a question we always return to is who are the poor and how do we identify them? But in the measure that we've done, which is only one measure and perhaps needs other measures to complement it, we are able very much to identify certain aspects of their lives that need to be addressed. And our hope is that in the future we would be able to have measures that would cover other very basic aspects that we know poor people want to be in the representation of their lives, like safety from violence. This comes up a great deal from poor people. That's an aspect of their deprivation, and yet it's never regularly measured. And data on violence are not present in any of the standard poverty surveys. So we do need to think about what is poverty and be self-critical if we're doing international comparisons about that and leave a great deal also for other local communities to fill in the gaps that can't be filled in at the international level.
Let me introduce again the guest in this hour of Focus, Sabina Alkire. She is here on the campus to deliver the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. She is here visiting. She's a director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative at University of Oxford. And we're talking here about how it is we think about poverty and some of the standard measures and then some things that economists like her are thinking that try to give you a better, more nuanced kind of picture that can be more helpful when it comes to thinking about development. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that you've made a couple of references to Amartya Sen, the Indian Nobel Prize-winning economist who is, I think, at Harvard.
Yes.
Now. I know that you have written quite a bit about him and about the approach to thinking about a poverty that he has developed, the capabilities approach, mm-hmm. which, as I understand, the little I understand about it has something to do, again, more to do with not so much the tangible assets that people have, like how much money they have or how much stuff they have,
mm-hmm.
but really focuses more on what it is they can or cannot do mm-hmm. in their lives, which I think he would argue and you would argue, again, this is it tells you an awful lot more about the challenges people face, the quality of their life, and then again, that could and should be something that would dictate your development strategies. But I'd like to have you just talk a little bit more about that, because I'm sure that for some people, his name will not be familiar, and this approach to thinking about economics probably will not be familiar. And I found it very interesting.
Yes. The words are not terribly elegant, perhaps, capabilities and functionings, but the approach mm-hmm. is very intuitive. And even among the poor people themselves in developing countries, it's something one can intuit immediately. His approach does not say that income is unimportant or that the resources a person has are unimportant, but that if we compare people and try to reduce inequalities or reduce poverty only in the space of resources, we will miss something very important. For example, if all of us have 2 kilos of rice a day, but some of us are pregnant, some of us have a very low metabolism, some of us are old, some of us are in the field every day, those kilos of rice that are equal among us will go with very different levels of nutritional output. As so, Sen is saying something very obvious, which is we should be concerned with people's bodies, people's lives, what they're able to do and be. And resources should be understood as essential means. But because we are different, we will need different amounts of resources to achieve the same levels. And this is particularly true among the very basic aspects of poverty, like nutritional status or health or education. So he's trying to shift this in terms of metrics. And it is quite significant. I was playing with data on rural India. My examples right now are coming from India. We found that 9% of the people only eat green vegetables or pulses in terms of their diet. And so you would think, well, malnutrition may not be too bad. But if you actually look at direct measures of a low body mass index, which is the kilograms per meter squared and is the consistent adult measure of malnutrition used, mm-hmm. then 42% of rural women have a low BMI. It's simply to say the variables you focus on have a huge impact on the kind of poverty you report. And so when it is possible, and it is not always possible, but when it is possible to report on actual attainments in education, not the years of schooling, because schooling quality varies so much and the teachers and all of that varies so much, then we should try to focus on these things more.
Yeah. I think this is very interesting approach. Again, I suppose, because what it does is I think it's focuses you to think on, well, what is quality of life all about?
Mm.
And what are the things that can really make a big difference? And that you also have to look carefully at them. You can't just say, well, these people over here, they have a school and these people over here have a school. So that means that they're both equal. You have to ask questions about, well, what kind of education is that school capable of delivering? And then do people actually have the luxury of being able to send their children to the school? Or do they rely on the labor of those children and they have to say, no, you can't go to school because you have to be here to work so that the family can survive? That across all sorts of things like that, you have to look very carefully at those. Again, I guess it goes back to the idea, well, what people can do, and you have to do that in a pretty deep level if you're actually going to make some comparisons between one group of people or one place or another.
Yes, yeah, and that is true. These are very, very practical examples, and the safety of children in school and whether the teachers turn up and whether the teachers can teach. So it's again, trying to find the simplest, the cheapest, the fastest way of getting an insight, which is incomplete and imperfect, but some insight into poverty, which will guide the people who wish to serve the poor.
Mm-hmm. Is trying to think a little bit differently about what your indicators are, your economic indicators or your well-being indicators. How common is that now within the field of economics? And is this something that's at all controversial or shaking the ground a little bit?
I think that the field is very much moving in this direction, the field being international institutions and donor agencies. It was helped in the year 2000 with the launch of Millennium Development Goals, which conceived of poverty in terms of not only income, but malnutrition, education, reductions in child and maternal mortality, reduction in AIDS, TB, malaria, and other aspects of environmental security. So that did broaden very much the mainstream understanding of what are acceptable indicators and an approach to poverty. I think where we are pushing the boundary is trying to bring in aspects of violence, of empowerment, of shame and humiliation, and of informal work. And these are aspects which are all articulated very much by poor people in participatory studies as being things that hurt in their life situation. And yet our measurement instruments have not kept up with their realities. Mm-hmm. And so our group do have survey instruments on each of these that we are fielding, very, very brief things to try to make it easy for people to slip some questions into their surveys that will give an insight onto a different dimension of their deprivation. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that those are the less conventional at the moment.
And that it does, maybe again I'm being overly concerned with numbers, but that it does give you an opportunity to make comparisons so that you could, I know this is being overly crude, but you could say overall one country rates scores 50 and one country scores 80 and one country maybe scores 100, or you break that down in particular categories and you could say in access education, particular country looks like this. And in conditions for women and children, it looks like this. And nutritionally, it looks like this. And access to, now people say are beginning to say access to the internet is a fundamental human right. So maybe you say, okay, IT scores gets that. And so those you actually can break it down enough so that then you can say Mexico looks like this and Bangladesh looks like this. And India looks like this, and actually make some comparisons across countries in a very detailed way and look at particular categories and see how they do.
Very much so. Our group are quantitative economists. We also very much care about talking with poor people and understanding their lives. But that means that everything that we produce can be compared. We've done it. We initially started with comparisons among 25 countries. Mm-hmm. Now we've gone beyond that, but with a more limited set of data. But the measurement technology that we use, I developed with my co-author James Foster at George Washington University, and its primary strength is that it can be decomposed. It can be taken apart in many different ways, so that you can see precisely how different groups of the population differ, and that we argue really does give a very colored graph, a very colored map of the situation, which is rich and informative. And that was done, in a sense, by a very simple technology that you can do on a calculator. You don't need to know fancy computer programs to do it. So an NGO, a charity, can it be able to understand it who's working on the ground? And it simply multiplies the number of people who are multidimensionally poor by the average number or weighted sum of indicators in which they are poor. And that very simple multiplication creates quite a powerful measurement of poverty, which is flexible and you can do in different ways depending on your particular program.
We have a caller. We'd want to bring them into the conversation. Let me tell you again that our guest is Sabina Alkire. She is the director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative. It's a research center within the University of Oxford that was launched in 2007, where they both study poverty and attempts to address and reduce poverty around the world. She is here on campus for the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. And she'll be giving a talk tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana, How an Adequate Notion of Human Flourishing Challenges Economics. That's the title. It is free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is our first caller, Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Two questions. One is, and what has been the impact of the Gross National Happiness Index, I guess is what it's called? Certainly, it says something about wealthy nations that, you know, that there might be, I think, what is it, a certain level of income. Once you get up to that level, is that the happiness maybe starts going the other direction or whatever. And the other one is that in regard to poverty among the wealthy nations, you know, is this also being, you know, in other words, studied too? I mean, we seem like we put that aside. We have a lot of, we have poverty in this country and other countries, and it seems like, is there a concern? Is it measured?
Yes.
Thank you very much. The Gross National Happiness Index, the concept was launched in 1972 in the Kingdom of Bhutan by the fourth king. But the first quantitative index was launched in November 2008. And it has nine dimensions in which they argue human happiness consists. These include health and education and living standard, but also governance and community vitality and culture and time use, how busy you are, and environment and emotional well-being. And so for each of these nine dimensions, they have a certain set of indicators, and they try to ask whether each person has achieved sufficiency, whether they have achieved enough for happiness in these indicators. And then they put them together for a national indicator of gross national happiness. So the features of this that are interesting is that it's not just what one dimension of how happy are you or how satisfied are you, but it's very holistic and so quite profound. And again, it can be, because they're using our measurement technology that I did with James Foster, it can be decomposed by different groups of the population and by dimension to understand how differences emerge. For example, in Bhutan, women were less deprived in terms of time use because they were very busy, and in terms of education. One could identify differences. I think that this is, as you suggested, a very good way of complementing our measurement of well-being in terms of income, because, as you said, above a certain threshold, income does not seem to be correlated with increases in reported subjective well-being or life satisfaction or unhappiness. There are different measures for that empirically in the West. And so trying to find the other dimensions that lead to a sense of fulfillment and flourishing and to measure these empirically is important. And I think also another reason that it is important is that some of the poverty among wealthy nations may be in terms of depression or mental illness or other aspects to which material measures of poverty, such as actually the one we're doing with UNDP, are blind because we don't have the data. So having a concerted attempt to look at some of the less well-reported and less conventional dimensions of human well-being is very welcome. The only thing that I would commend very much is Bhutan's commitment to having happiness be considered in a multidimensional sense. And this coheres with Amartya Sen's approach, which sees happiness in terms of the mental mood barometer as being one dimension of well-being, but it needs to be complemented by other kinds of information. So a person could be very unhappy, but that's because they have a newborn baby and they've been up all night. And in other aspects of their life, they might be flourishing. And so not replacing income with a unidimensional measure of your happiness, but rather with a multidimensional well-being of that shows the landscape of your life, I think would be a step forward in the West. And that was something that the Quality of Life subcommittee on the Sarkozy Commission that was chaired by Alan Krueger, who works on happiness, that they ended up recommending.
Thank you.
Right. And the other, I think that the caller also raises an interesting point about how it is we talk about poverty, that we spend a lot of time talking about poverty in the developing world, But we know that within the developed world, there is poverty.
Very much so.
And that it's something that perhaps doesn't get the same kind of attention, or maybe we don't think about it in the same way.
Yes, I confess that I work primarily on poverty in developing countries, so I feel very hesitant to speak much except from personal experience, where I certainly have observed in different kinds of poverty in the U.S. and other places. And I think that having this kind of analysis, and I know there is interest in some parts of the U.S. in implementing a multidimensional poverty measure, that that would be quite interesting because the U.S. has been reporting quite a simple notion of poverty since the 70s with Molly Urshanksky's income poverty line. And so it might be time to go beyond that.
Yeah. I do think that this whole area of happiness is quite interesting, particularly when you get to the question of how it is you want to go about trying to measure it. One of the problems being that it's a little on the subjective side. And, of course, one of the ways that you could determine is a society happy is you go out and ask people. But that's maybe not the best – it's not going to give you the clearest answer. So then you want to have something that doesn't rely on subjectivity where you can, again, have some kind of objective measures and then you can give you something to work with. But if you go all through that process, then the question is, what do you do with that? And I know that there are some people who argue for good reasons that governments should actually be actively involved in maximizing happiness for their citizens. That I'm sure, though, in many places around would be a controversial assertion to make, where governments would say, look, it's not up to us. We can't make people happy. That's their individual thing. That's up to them to decide what it is that would make them happy. How do you think about that whole business of once you have your measures, what do you do with that?
I think that's a very exciting question, and it's a question which will, I think, get a lot of play in the next few years. Mm. And the problem with subjective data is, and particularly with happiness, is that it also reflects not only a person's true estimation of themselves, but their frame of reference, the group they're comparing themselves to. Now, in the West, this may not be so much a problem, but Sen speaks of, you know, widows in India who are very devout people and who are blossoming with happiness. And yet, if you were to judge the other aspects of their life, you would find acute deprivation and suffering. And yet they have achieved this ability by dampening down their expectations and becoming grateful for small mercies. They've achieved the ability to be very happy. Now, that's a good thing. But if that were the only indicator of their life a policymaker used, he might then or she might take resources from serving this acutely poor widow and give them to a very depressed, rich Indian who hadn't achieved his bonus or whatever, or her bonus. So I think there's a problem with seeing mental states in isolation from other aspects, which is quite dangerous because if people have managed to achieve some kind of happiness with their state, they shouldn't be penalized for that. At the same time, I think it would be very creative to understand, you know, what are the new kinds of investments. I don't think this is perhaps a time in the climate in the U.S. when a great deal of government programs on increasing happiness would be welcomed with glee. But in Bhutan, it's interesting. They are trying to think, how can the government support emotional well-being? Should they teach mindfulness in schools? They're trying to experiment with concrete ways of addressing, through public policy, the less well-addressed aspects of flourishing. But I think it's too early for that to be rolled out on a large scale, and it's probably more appropriate for private sector initiatives and charities at this point. And I think the final concern is that happiness, again, perhaps more in developing countries, but I'm not so sure, will reflect also people's aspirations. So there are two states of India. Kerala has a very high life expectancy. Bihar has a very low life expectancy. Mm-hmm. In Kerala, the women were asked, how happy are you with your health? And they said, oh, it's terrible. And in Bihar, they were asked the same questions. And they said, oh, we're quite satisfied. So their subjective perceptions were diametrically opposed to their objective measures of health. And so I think understanding that's why I said it has to be used with care, but it is, I think, an important aspect to try to bring in. My concern with your suggestion of perhaps not using the subjective is then you try to see the happiness literature coming out of psychology rather than from development can see people as patients. And it's the job of the expert to say what makes you happy in terms of your marriage, in terms of your work, in terms of other life events. And Amartya Sen's approach or our approach is very much in trying to empower people as leaders, as experts in their own life, in their own poverty, and relying on their insights and not seeing them as objects or victims. And so there's a bit of a concern that the happiness literature would undermine that emphasis on building local capacity and building on local knowledge and talents.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller up in the northwestern corner of the state, up in Elburn. We'll go there, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, I was wondering how you feel about the United States. I think in my eyes it looks like the poverty level has risen quite dramatically in the last few years, and I think I see a lot of unhappy people. Although I think it's odd that whenever there's a disaster in another part of the world, and something should happen, you know, like the earthquakes and the floods and the tsunamis, we tend to pour out all of our money to help other countries, but yet we don't help ourselves. I was wanting to get a comment from you on that, and thanks. So I'll get off.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. As I said, I'm a bit hesitant to speak about the U.S., but it's very warm coming from England, so I've appreciated the weather today. In terms of poverty, I don't know the poverty figures officially here, and I should do. But I don't also know if the welling up of compassion and resources for the earthquake versus the U.S. might also simply be people's normal responses to a sudden event versus a chronic event. So most of the poor, whether they're in developing countries or in the U.S., are chronically poor. They're in that situation and they don't make the headlines. And so they tend to generate less public compassion and outpouring. And it is only when disaster strikes, when there are emergencies, that people's responses change. And that may be something that needs to be addressed. Amartya Sen writes, you know, we've become so coolly accustomed to the ongoing poverty, and it should give us much more cause for alarm and for impatience and a response than it does. And I believe that would be the case as much within the U.S. as outside. And so that's almost more how can we portray people's obligation to help the people who are poor year in and year out, rather than just have become suddenly poor through a disaster not of their making.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Sabina Alkire. She's here on the campus to give the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. She'll be speaking on the topic, How an Adequate Notion of Human Flourishing Challenges Economics, tomorrow night at 8 in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory. It's free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend is certainly welcome. She is the director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative. That's a research center within the University of Oxford that was launched in 2007. She actually grew up in Champaign, did some of her schooling at University of Illinois, and then went on to Oxford, where she studied both theology and economics. In addition to being an economist, she's also an Anglican priest. And we're pleased to have her here on the show. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we have a caller here in Champaign, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if Hazel Henderson's economics has affected you, but it sounds very reminiscent. And I'm also thinking back to many, many years ago when a self-described synergist like Buckminster Fuller suggested that East St. Louis was the worst ghetto in the world from a holistic point of view, that it wasn't, some of the indicators weren't as bad as other places around the world. But he said from a point of view of having a rationale or an explanation or a worldview, that the people there were just sort of without, bereft of any sort of narrative to describe their themselves. And that from that point of view, he thought it was, I don't know whether you can comment on that. The notion of the right to the internet is also preceded by UN material, the right to communicate narrative from the, what would have that been, the 80s, like early 80s, late 70s. And it seems to me that in your methodology, and I don't want to get too hung up in methodology, but just the idea of being giving people in these circumstances sort of a sympathetic ear, a feeling that they're actually being paid attention to, in some ways it's good in and of itself, but it would also sort of skew the data in some way. I don't know if that's a clear enough point to take up in these last few minutes, but I guess I want to ask for your reactions to that as well.
Thank you very much. Yes, Hazel Henderson's economics certainly is inspiring, and it has common ground in really taking a holistic, human-centered approach and trying to wrestle with economics to see how it can contain more of the insights that she would want it to contain. And so I do have a great deal of respect for her work. In terms of your point on in a sense, alienation in Eastern St. Louis or in other places, that is something we are not quite sure what to do about, but we are struggling with. And very concretely, what we have done is tried to incorporate into our survey modules Michael Steger's questions on meaning. You can't measure religiosity across cultures. You can't measure spirituality very well. But we're trying to figure out, can you measure, in a sense, the sense of worthwhileness, the inner anchor that people have, whether it their inner anchor comes from religion or from a relationship or from music or the arts or a philosophy, however they get it. There are some people who seem to have lives that are pregnant with meaning and others that are very distressed and empty. And so if that were possible to measure, and we're not yet sure that it is, I think that would be a very important aspect to come in. However, what a government would do to try to increase that baffles me. In terms of the right to the internet, but more generally communication, I think that is, in a sense, one of the frontiers of work in the next 10 years. In the following way, OFI's work is supported by the Government of Canada, and they are very interested in how do we obtain better information on poverty. Thus far, we obtain information every 3 years or every 5 years from countries. You think of how we get quarterly reports on unemployment and different economic indicators, and yet on poverty it's very slow and it's very incomplete. So the question is, if poor people have mobile phones, are there questions that we could ask that would give us just-in-time information? You know, what has been the effect of the financial crisis on the poor? One of the answers is we do not know very well because we don't have a survey since it happened in most countries. And so exploring the two things you said, one is if there is more connectivity, how we can obtain different mechanisms and channels of learning about their lives. And the second is whether these would be accurate or whether they would be distorted, whether people would overstate their poverty in hope of gain, or whether we could find a way of having a more realistic assessment of their lives. So I think those are, in a sense, questions that a lot of different institutions are working on quite actively.
Well, I appreciate the caller's comments. We are coming down to the point where we have maybe 5-6 minutes left. I have an email here that I'd like to read to you, and maybe you can talk about this. The person here was listening to the conversation about this idea of trying to come up with some standard dimensions, standard measures of quality of life in any particular country so that then you can have a better understanding about what people's life is and then also make some comparisons one country to another. And the person listening says, well, it seems like probably some dimensions would be pretty standard across countries, but others would vary, and wondered, could you talk a little bit about how, say, the dimensions that you might choose to look at in a place like Bhutan or a place like Mexico were actually chosen, and can you imagine how they might be chosen in other countries?
Yes, that's a very splendid issue, and it's a very practical issue that people are struggling with. To give some concrete examples, in Chile and in Colombia, both governments are interested in creating a new multidimensional poverty index and trying to think about their dimensions. In Bolivia, they would like to create an index of para vivir bien. What does it mean to live well? And so again and again across countries, this question is coming up. What dimensions do we choose? Early, I had done some work just pulling together existing literature where people had tried to identify dimensions of human well-being and found, to my surprise, that the numbers of categories that they identify is not limitless. It's actually, there's a lot of repetition and a lot of replication. So some of the standard dimensions that often are mentioned include, obviously, health and education, work and relationships, something about the inner life of the person, something about their empowerment or their ability to have voice and political freedom, and something about culture or the arts or faith and philosophy, that those dimensions often come up. The art is picking indicators within those. And this is where I think there's a trade-off to be made, which I think should be made, that there will be some ways that we can compare countries internationally and some in which the best measures will be national. They will carry the melody of the culture, the texture of the social life and the political life of that particular nation, and they cannot be made international. Probably there need to be measures at different levels, tailored to different purposes, and the international is the crudest.
We just have about 5 minutes. There are a lot of things we could talk about, and I realize here I'm getting into an area that would be worth another conversation. But the United Nations adopted some very ambitious goals for international development and set targets for we'd like to be at this place at this time. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you think we're doing and whether what we're talking about here this morning, that is maybe different ways of trying to assess a country's well-being, does that help? How does this contribute to this larger sort of project of trying to overall improve people's lives around the world?
Yes. In the year 2000, the United Nations, all heads of states approved a Millennium Declaration, and that gave rise to 8 goals and 49 measurable targets that were to be met by the year 2015. And we're at 2010, two-thirds of the way there, and in September there will be another Millennium Summit in the UN in New York to assess progress. And the progress is very clear that in some of the goals, such as income, poverty, mainly thanks to China's tremendous progress, we will make them at a global level, but probably not at every nation level. Mm. But in others like malnutrition, there's been regress. For the first time in history, over 1 billion people are malnourished at the present moment. And this was the numbers have gone up, and there are others that have gone backwards. However, I think that the message is clear. The goals were adopted not because they were beautiful, not because they were inspiring, but because they were feasible. They were something that we could do for the poorest among us to really help alleviate their suffering. And they're not the most important. They don't include everything that's valuable, but they were feasible, and I believe that they remain feasible. That despite, you know, the delays of the first 10 years, that if many more churches, civil groups, political groups really dedicated their effort and energy, they could be met by 2015. And I think the world would be a far better place for that. And so in a sense, my hope is that there will be a reflection in 2010 that's not a discouragement. We didn't make them. We're probably not going to make them. But that will galvanize a call to action to accelerate progress towards them. And so OFI's work in developing this multidimensional poverty index is partly very much geared toward that. All but 2 of our indicators are MDG indicators. And what we do is we look at every household and we see how many deprivations batter that household at the same time. That helps us, one, to see who is the poorest, but it also helps us to see how these deprivations are interconnected. And so what are the high-impact causal pathways that can interrupt deprivation most effectively? Mm-hmm. We all know that resources are going to go down and that politicians are going to struggle to protect their aid donations in the years to come. And so the real question is, can we find very effective ways of reducing poverty in the next few years that enable us to meet these targets and have some confidence as a global community that we are able to care for the poorest among us.
Yeah. Just as a way of finishing up, having looked at recently some of the research about happiness, I think it's interesting to note that it, among the things that people take into consideration, they consider a part of well-being in their society and something that perhaps contributes to people's feelings of happiness, indeed has to do with the quality of the government that they have. Mm. And whether they feel that it's legitimate and whether they feel that it's addressing their needs in significant ways. That contributes a lot to people's feelings of happiness and satisfaction with their lives. Would you ever think of as one of your indicators well-being in a country something that would try to measure how successful governments have been or how serious they are trying to address those things?
That's actually really interesting. We tried in the poverty index to include something on political freedom, and there were no data. Mm-hmm. They considered trying to establish a separate index, and it's quite difficult to do. But your question was interesting because, in a sense, it's more concrete. How well is a government fulfilling its obligations to its people? And that actually could be measured and would be interesting to do. Mm-hmm. The Voices of the Poor study which looked at poor people in 60 countries in the year 2000, they asked people what institutions are important and effective in your lives. And they were shocked at how low governments ranked in that assessment. And so those are subjective questions, but coming up with a better account of that, I think, would be a very interesting way forward.
Yeah, certainly, though, I suppose it runs the risk of irritating a lot of governments,
yes.
which might not be very constructive. Whether it would be true or not, that's something else. It might not be very constructive. Mm. Well, I think we're just about at the point that we're going to have to finish. Overall, are you optimistic about the progress that we're making?
I think it's a fascinating time, and we feel very lucky to be working on these things because there's openness, there's hope, there's, I think, possibilities to do some creative, not only research, which is what we do, but creative action. So yes, I am optimistic and hopeful.
We have to leave it there, but I do want to mention one more time that our guest, Sabina Alkar, will be giving a talk on the campus. This is for tomorrow, the 7th. This is the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. She'll be speaking on the topic How an Adequate Notion of Human Flourishing Challenges Economics. That's 8 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. It is free and open to the public. Our guest is the director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative. That's a research center within the University of Oxford, launched in 2007. And I am sure that they have a website. If you're interested in finding out more about them, you could go there and read up on it. And thank you very much.
Thank you.